Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of The Morning Show with hosts Phil Huff and the finally returning Julie Calamine.
I am finally returned, Phil. Good morning. How are you?
Good, good. Were you successful?
Well, yes. I went on a little fishing trip to the Missouri River in Craig, Montana and had a great time and caught some nice rainbow trout. It was fun.
Excellent.
Nice weather.
Excellent, excellent. Well, we missed you last weekend and I had a great weekend. We got out with some kids from the University of Montana's Wilderness and Civ program and dug trail tread. We showed them what... On the ground, boots on the ground, wilderness stewardship is all about over the weekend.
I bet that was fun. Did the kids enjoy it?
They did. And we managed to dodge the rain on a day where it was supposed to be a 90% chance of rain. We had a good solid 5.5 hours before the rain started falling.
You know how to make things fun for kids. That might not have been fun otherwise.
Yeah, well, at that age, anything is okay as long as you're prepared for it. So speaking of the weather, today we have patchy fog. In fact, it seemed like almost total fog coming in across the Long Bridge. The high is supposed to get to 55. This afternoon, it will be sunny and a low tonight of 35. So we're getting into that fall mix of weather. Tomorrow, we have a 20% chance of showers and patchy fog and then partly sunny. So it's kind of going to be a repeat, but with a little more moisture. A high of 54, low of 37. It continues that way Thursday, but then Friday, it's supposed to clear up and be sunny through Friday and Saturday, which is good news. Don't we have a trash pickup along the highway this weekend?
We do on Saturday, so fingers crossed that the weather stays nice for that. I hope everyone will be joining us.
Yeah. Well, it's fall, and fall means elk season. So we're here today to talk about elk with Barb Moore and Laura Wolf from the Idaho Department of Fish and Game. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yes, yeah. It's great to have you both. And what fine fall elk hunting weather with the kind of sunny, warm days and the cool nights. I bet hunters are enjoying that.
I think they are. I think they're enjoying the fact that the snow started to melt up high and they can get back to their hunting spots.
Boy, that's for sure. Well, I'd like to start by asking you both to tell us just a little bit about yourselves. You've been working on an elk study, but you work for Fish and Game. So tell us how you got to be in the positions you're in today.
Okay, I'll start. Yes, this is Barb, and I was born and raised here in North Idaho. And growing up, I kind of gravitated naturally towards two things. And one of them was the outdoors. Our family camped a lot growing up and recreated outside a lot. And so I just loved being outside. And I also loved animals, and I was fascinated by variety of different animals. So when it became time to figure out what I wanted to do when I grew up, wildlife biology kind of seemed like that natural fit of where I could work outdoors, be outdoors, and also pursue my interests in wildlife. So I went to University of Idaho and got my bachelor's degree in wildlife resources, and I started working for Idaho Department of Fish and Game right after I graduated from college, doing a variety of things. My first job was actually here in Sandpoint, working out Trout Creek property just east of town, and did a variety of things on the ground, habitat work, and I trapped black bears. I did snowmobile multiple winters looking for forest carnivores, and then I went back to school to get my master's degree from University of Montana, working studying black bears and a population north of Bonner's Ferry, and came back to work for the department, and I've been working for the department for 15 years now. So
neat. Doesn't look like you could have been working with them that long.
Thank you.
You've talked a little bit about both habitat and population, and I understand there's some focus within the wildlife biology on either one or both of those.
Yeah, this is Laura. Within the department, most folks are either a population biologist or a habitat biologist, both wildlife biologists, but they kind of focus on different things. So population biologists tend to be the ones that are surveying game species to figure out how many there are, what their survival rates are, if the population is increasing or decreasing. They often are the ones also to help make recommendations on hunting seasons with the help of harvest data. We do public meetings, a lot of public outreach, running big game check stations, which we've been doing the last couple weekends, versus habitat biologists in the state tend to be a little bit more focused on their wildlife management areas, so WMAs. A lot of them here in the Panhandle are focused on waterfowl management, so that can be improving wetland habitat, planting native shrubs and trees, can be water level management to make it an appropriate depth for ducks to make them want them either to make breeding habitat better or to make it appropriate for ducks that are moving through, so they'll land and loaf for a while. So those are things that habitat biologists do that are a little bit different. I myself am a habitat and population biologist. I think I'm the only one in the state right now, so it's pretty fun to be able to dabble in both sides. Obviously, there's a lot of overlap between habitat and population, so it's pretty fun to be able to mix those two positions.
And so how did you become interested in wildlife biology? With a name like Laura Wolf, I'd assume you were born into it somehow?
It's actually a married name, but I thought it was pretty appropriate, yes. I've always been interested in the outdoors and wildlife. I think I decided I wanted to be a wildlife biologist when I was about 10, and I'm pretty stubborn, so I stuck with it. I went to UC Davis for my undergraduate near Sacramento. I've worked for the Park Service, the Forest Service, and then knew that I wanted to get a master's degree so I could pursue a professional career in wildlife biology. So I went to Auburn in Alabama and actually studied feral pigs at Fort Benning. So a little bit different than what I do now. But I moved back west, and I've been working for Idaho Fish and Game for 11 years now. Started out in the salmon region and then moved up to Coeur d'Alene.
And it's interesting to me that you finished your education at Auburn, because we recently had a gal on who was working on a painted turtle study at Round Lake State Park, who is at Auburn at this time.
So that's funny.
Second Auburn, yes. Pretty neat.
Yeah.
Somehow they migrate up here.
I know. It's a good place to be.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the study and introduce it with the concept that it first came across our desks as the elk mortality study for the Panhandle Zone. But as we were talking about, it's really meant to inform survivability.
Yep. Yeah, we kind of like the glass half full approach and, refer to it as survival of elk and monitoring their survival. So the effort, we started in 2014, and the study was initiated because we were starting to see a greater variability in the number of cows and calves that we would count during our aerial surveys in the wintertime. And this was not only a pattern that we saw here in our Panhandle region, but also statewide. So we started putting GPS collars on adult cows and six-month-old calf elk to monitor their survival over the year. And if they died, to also determine their cause of death.
And by variability, do you mean that you saw better survival rates in some areas than others? Was that what you were noticing? Or?
Some areas, and then also throughout the years, where it was higher some years, lower some years, and just variable overall.
And so the study began in 2014 and went through two seasons, is that right?
We're working on our fourth.
Okay.
This will be actually number five coming up this winter. So, we have quite a few years of data.
And the location where the studies were conducted, tell us a little bit about the geography.
In our region, we have two areas. This is a statewide effort. Last winter, I think we had over 800 elk collared in the state. We've collared nearly 300 cows and six-month-old calves since 2014. And those were in the Coeur d'Alene River drainage, so our game management unit 4. And also the St. Joe River drainage and units 6 and 7.
300 sounds like a pretty high number, but then there's a lot of elk on the landscape. Do you have any feeling for, as a percentage, how many of the elk you had under collar?
That's a good question. And we really don't have a strong grasp of that because so a lot of the other regions in the state rely heavily on aerial surveys for estimating the abundance of their populations. And they go through, they count the number of animals. There's models that correct for the number of animals that you miss to give you a population estimate. But because the Panhandle is so densely forested, there's so many trees, we miss a lot of animals. And there's just not a good enough model out there that could help correct for the number of animals that we miss. So we don't really have a really strong grasp of the exact population abundance, but we have a really good idea of the trend of the population and growth.
And we do that because not only do we have survival rates, but we can also get recruitment. When we fly, we can get calf-cow ratios. Even though we can't see all the elk, we can see enough to get an idea of how many are recruited into the population. So we don't know how many there are, but we can tell whether the population is increasing or stable or decreasing over time.
I know in certain areas that are similarly challenged as North Idaho, biologists will fly over and they can look at a herd of elk, for instance, and say, yeah, this number is collared. So they can use some math to proportionally guesstimate at the population trends. That falls short here, it sounds like.
I think that you would have to make sure you were collaring in a very random fashion across the landscape to be right. able to use that method. And we're definitely focusing on areas where we have a good chance of catching animals. While we do try to spread it out throughout a geographic area.
It is more focused and concentrated.
I think that would be somewhat difficult. Yeah.
And for the listeners that don't understand all of our terminology, what is recruitment?
Recruitment is the number, basically the births. So how many young are being added to the population each year.
And how do the calves, how do the babies do when they're captured and collared? I think I recall reading something about moose babies being collared in Minnesota, and it wasn't always that great for them. How do the baby elk do?
They do okay. So we do our captures during the wintertime. So at this point, they're 6-7 months old. So they're not these young neonatal calves at that time. And we do it in the wintertime when elk are concentrated in groups, when they're basically hanging out in lower elevations, more open environments. And so this makes it easier to capture them when they're, you got a lot of them together, they're in open areas where you don't have to deal as much with the trees. And so we dart the elk from a helicopter. And so initially we're not, you know, too close to them. It's a little different operation that way. And then a crew jumps out of the helicopter and processes the animal. We put a GPS collar on them at that time. We put ear tags. We collect fecal and blood samples for disease and pregnancy surveillance. And we also will do some measurements of their body to understand their body condition.
It sounds way safer than trying to trap a bear and put a collar around it.
In some ways, of course, the helicopter has its risks, and we're, you know, flying in areas with a lot of trees and whatnot. So it's an impressive operation to watch the pilot work and try to get an animal in the right spot at the right angle and close enough where the gunner can get a good shot and hit the target. So
I think we can all intuit that you put a collar on it, you can track the elk's movements. What else can the collar tell you about the elk and its survivability?
Yes, so the movements, of course, are an important aspect that we gain from the collars. The habitats that they use, the habitats that they might avoid, and their overall survival. So these collars they're programmed to collect two locations a day, and the GPS collars work very similar to a handheld GPS unit. You know, they communicate with the satellite. That information is sent back down to an online web service, so we can actually get on our computers, log on every day, and figure out where each animal is, which is a pretty great technology that we have available these days.
Yeah, and unlike older technologies where you might lose track of an animal for a period of time.
Right?
Yes.
And sometimes that still happens. We have some that malfunction, but overall it's very different than the old VHF collars where you'd have to either find animals from aerial surveys or on foot, and you are limited by the time of day, the season, the weather, different patterns. So there was a lot of times we didn't know where some animals were.
So you get
were.
More data more efficiently.
Exactly.
So let's move to the cause of death. This sounds like the makings for a TV show, the CSI.
Yes. So when we get a mortality signal sent to our email, that means that the animal hasn't moved for several hours. So once in a while, the animal actually is just resting, but most of the time it means that the animal has died. We try to get out there as soon as possible within a day or two to be able to figure out what happened. So when we walk into a site, we try to locate the animal, and we spend time walking around the carcass to try to figure out if we can find any signs that would indicate what the cause of death was. So we're looking for drag trails. We're looking for hair, either elk hair or predator hair, tracks in the snow or in the dirt. And then the predators that affect elk, primarily mountain lions and wolves, at this stage of their age, they're pretty large by the time they're 6-7 months old, have different signatures in terms of how they attack and what they do with the carcass afterwards. So we're looking for, in the terms of mountain lions, we're looking for caches. So mountain lions often will drag their their prey to a kind of a hidden spot under low-hanging vegetation in a spot that is not as easy to see. And then they will cover it up once they've consumed usually some of the organs. They will use dirt or leaves or snow so that they kind of bury the animal. Whereas wolves tend to consume the carcass a bit more quickly, and you'll see it spread out over a bit larger of an area. They will be they're a bit messier eaters. So you're more apt to see some of the rumen contents involved in the carcass, whereas lions are a bit neater and they're going to separate those stomach contents off to the side, so it's a little bit cleaner.
It's the typical cat versus dog situation.
Pretty much.
And seems so.
It doesn't sound like coyotes probably are the cause as often, just due to the hunting mechanics.
I don't think a coyote could take very easily an elk that large. It is impressive, though, to me that a mountain lion can take down an adult cow by itself. That's pretty impressive in itself. And then bears, too, while can be predators of young elk, by the time we have collars on them, a bear, while they're also usually hibernating in the wintertime, but it would be a bit too difficult for them to take a large elk.
Tell us a bit about the findings. Were there more mountain lion kills than wolf kills? What were your results?
Yes. Yeah, so overall, I mean, what we're finding for cows is that they have really high survival rates. We've had 94% of our cows that survive. So it seems almost as if, you know, once they turn a year old, survival rates are consistently high, no matter what the winter conditions are. Calves, on the other hand, are a bit different, and it's more variable and reduced survival rates, which is expected for young of the year of most species. And before we get into the actual cause-specific mortality, I'll share with you the calf survival. And we've found that calf survival is dependent upon the winter weather conditions. And this is not surprising to us, because we know that winter weather can... it's one of the primary factors that affects elk survival. You know, deep snow can make it hard for elk to move through. They burn through their energy reserves much quicker. Deep snow can also cause them to not be able to escape predation very easily or as quickly. And of course, it also covers their food sources. So it's a big driver in elk survival. And what we found in our mild winters during 2015 and 2016 winters, that elk calves survive really well. We had 80% of our elk calves survive, which is quite high for a young animal. Contrast that to last winter, as you guys might remember, 2017, where it was a bit colder, snowier. We had a lot of snow in the low elevations where elk will go in the wintertime. It was on the ground for a long duration of time, and only 50% of our calves survived last year. So quite a bit reduced
quite a big range. And of course, in the last, this will be year five, really big snow years. 1996 is a huge year. And looking back, and I don't remember the exact data, Laura's nodding her head, she probably has it, but it was a bad year for elk. It was a good year for snow.
Yes. Yeah, there was definitely probably even lower survival than we had last year in the 96-97, because that was a very heavy snow year for sure.
Yeah, and again, I think 2008 and 2011, big snow years. So hopefully the study continues on into a year where we get closer to that anomaly and can study it.
Yeah, it would be interesting. It's not as good, of course, for the elk population, but it's interesting. Yeah, it's good information.
Yeah. So can you extrapolate the data taking the survey in the Coeur d'Alene and St. Joe's drainage? What can it tell us about other parts of the panhandle?
You can't extrapolate very easily. So we can use that data for those areas. We'll use that data to manage elk populations in, and that's it's a pretty large area, units 6, 7, and 9 of the panhandle. But beneficially, we have elk collared throughout the state. Every region has elk collared in numerous areas. So everybody is getting this survival data and this cause-specific mortality data throughout the state to help them make management decisions. Even over in Montana, they've done similar studies looking at elk cause-specific mortality and survival.
Okay, but they're just not as large. The studies wouldn't be as large as yours.
No, they are, similar in scale. Yep. And they are, to get back to what we're seeing as far as the animals that die, they see the same trends where in, as far as calves go, in the winter of 2015-16, when it was, again, those mild winters, 80% of our calves survived. and 14% were killed by mountain lions, 3% were wolves, 1% were disease, and 2% was unknown. We could not determine cause of death. And then looking again back to last winter, 2017, where it was a heavier snow year, again, 50% of those calves died, and 16% were killed by mountain lions. 16% were also caused by malnutrition or starvation. 6% were wolves, 2% were disease, and 2% were parasite load, and 8% we just could not determine that cause. So
the variable seems to be starvation, and the success, relatively speaking, go mountain lions.
Yeah, mountain lions.
You're a cat fan, right?
Go Cougs.
Yeah, go Cougs.
That was bad, wasn't it? I was interested in the statistic about parasites because I know that is a impactful problem for moose populations. Mm-hmm. It sounds like it's relatively small for elk populations.
Elk are a lot better at grooming than moose.
Ah.
As are deer, just better at getting those parasites off, external parasites, so mm-hmm. you don't see parasite mm-hmm. loads being as big of an issue for deer and elk. So the fact that we did see a slight increase last winter to us really showed that their body conditions were a lot worse than they had been in previous mm-hmm. winters.
So tell us a little bit about how the results of this study can then inform wildlife management decisions from the agency's perspective.
Yeah, and that's a great question. Another interesting result that we found is that there are areas in the panhandle within our study area that elks, particularly calf elk, survive much better than other areas. And these areas are kind of more front country units, we refer to them as, where they're privately owned, managed forests. So a lot of industrial timberland where they've had, recent timber harvest. So some younger age forests where there's, you know, a bit more open, a lot of good grasses, forbs on the ground for elk to eat. Contrast that with more backcountry units that are publicly owned, more unmanaged forests where they haven't seen much timber harvest or burns in many years. And so they're a bit more densely forested, not as much good food on the forest floor for them to consume. And so we found in those front country, those younger age structure forests, that calf elk their survival was 92% in those areas compared to 60% in those backcountry, more densely forested areas. And we're still kind of trying to tease apart all the reasons that we might see this contrast between those areas. Predator density and snow depth might also play a role. But from what we've seen from those different survival rates in the areas, we is a reflection in our harvest season, our hunting season this year. And in elk, where we now have a cow elk season, we haven't had one on the general tag since 2011. And if you had looked through there, the restriction is on or within a mile of private land. And so that's where this information comes from, where we're seeing higher survival rates of elk on private land, younger age structure forest, compared to more of those backcountry units.
So the restriction is the successful hunter has to be a mile or more away, not within a mile of private.
Okay. So basically we're getting at areas where our population is doing well, increasing, we have high survival rates, and that's where we have the opportunity to have cow harvest. So it's a little bit different of a structure instead of just all of this unit or all of the panhandle. We were really trying to key in on areas where elk populations are doing well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right. And sort of conflicting with private mm-hmm. agriculture and that sort of thing too. So kind of a win-win situation. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious. I have one question about elk calves, and I'm wondering how survivability of elk calves compare to our other ungulates like deer and moose. It seems like a high survival rate for elk.
It is, and I would expect that they're going to have somewhat higher survival than a deer would because of their body size. So as going into winter, if it's a little bit hard, so we had 50% survival last winter. I would imagine deer fawns had lower survival than that mm-hmm. just due to body size.
Yeah,
it's going to be harder for them to keep their fat reserves through the winter.
And moose, how do they do? Is that part of your area of expertise or not?
No, it's outside overall. We don't have any collars on moose to really get a good feeling for that. But As we were talking about before, the ticks, the external parasites, that we do know that from other studies nearby in Washington and in Montana, that ticks can take a heavy toll on calf moose in particular. Mm-hmm. Just their small body size, not those fat reserves built up yet.
Well, we appreciate you coming in this morning. We're running a little short in time. Are there any last-minute thoughts before we go for the listeners about the study? Where can they find more information out if they're so interested?
We have on our Fish and Game website, you can go to the Panhandle region and check our blogs, which you can get a little bit more information about this study. And we will have continuing blogs about this study as we get more information.
Mm-hmm. And would you say generally it was helpful in understanding whether the elk population is healthy and growing? Was that the conclusion, or conclusions you might share for last minute or two?
Well, we are definitely seeing the difference in, like she mentioned, the front country industrial forest versus the backcountry forest service. Mm-hmm. I think that there's different trends going on. I think in some areas that they are increasing, particularly closer to private land, and in some areas they're probably stable, potentially declining in some areas.
Well, we'll have to have you back next year after the next winter study and get an update and see where the trend's going. But thank you for coming in.
We'd love to come back.
Yeah, yes. Thanks for having us.
And what fascinating work. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So if you're just tuning in, this is 88.5 KRFY, listener-supported radio for North Idaho. We've been listening to Barb Moore and Laura Wolf talk about the Panhandle Elk Mortality Survivability Study. We're going to take a short music break and then come back with our second set of guests from the North Idaho Crisis Line, Catherine Perus and Amy Topp. So hang on for right now. We're going to listen to a little bit. Duran Duran, Hungry Like the Wolf.
No better song for our previous guests.
Cat Scratch Fever, maybe, if we had known that cats came out on top, but who knew?
Oh, well, we let the underdog win out this time.
If you're just tuning in, this is 88.5 KRFY in Ponderay. Our first guests were Laura Wolf and Barb Moore from Idaho Fish and Game talking about the Panhandle Elk Mortality Study.
Or Survivability Study.
Survivability. But we're back with two guests who are here to talk about the North Idaho Crisis Line, Barb Perus and Amy Topp. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, it's great to have you both here. Well, what a great topic this time of the year. I'm good that you're here, and I'd like you to each tell us about your organizations. Amy, would you like to begin?
Yep, I'm here. Bonner Partners in Care Clinic. It's a local free clinic for people who do not have health insurance in our community. They can come in and see a doctor, refill prescriptions, get testing, things that they need to stay healthy.
Mm-hmm. And Catherine?
Yes, I'm here from NAMI Far North and the North Idaho Crisis Services. NAMI Far North is an organization set up to support individuals living with mental illness and their family members. And two of us were a part of coming up with the idea for the North Idaho Crisis Services.
So it's a combination of your two organizations.
Yep. Yeah, yes. We partner together.
Okay.
So tell us a little bit about that partnership and the services that are offered.
Well, we started out about 3 years ago, Ann Wimberly and myself, going around town talking with people. We were concerned about the issues our community had with access to mental health care, crisis support. We have very few options other than calling law enforcement, which is not something anybody wants to do because it indicates, you know, things are really out of hand. And so we were looking for ways to increase the availability of services to individuals who might be having any type of crisis in our community. And we came up with the idea of North Idaho Crisis. We implemented a after-hours crisis line that is staffed with licensed mental health clinicians on December 31st, 2015. And have received a lot of calls. We work closely with law enforcement and, of course, with Bonner Partners in Care Clinic.
And so the timing after hours, that's because that's when most likely those calls are needed?
Correct. You only have two options, the ER or 911. And many times we're hoping that what we can do is do more upstream, that people would be more willing to call before it's become a law enforcement issue. so that they can receive help. The idea of having licensed mental health clinicians is because you've got someone trained on the phone, mm-hmm. someone who knows our local community resources, not a hotline from Boise, which the hotline from Boise does a wonderful job, but they're mm-hmm. a long ways away.
Sure.
And so what are the folks who are fielding the phone calls? I'm sure there's no typical call, but what are they able to do?
We receive calls from people who maybe have depression and anxiety, whose life situation is out of control. People looking for help with issues such as a water bill that ended up being for like 29,000 gallons for 1 month for one little old lady. We were just able to take them by the hand and coordinate getting that resolved for them through the connections that we all know because of our work here. Mm-hmm.
You know, drug problems are big in many communities these days. Do you take calls from people with that sort of problem or not?
We
so much?
Take calls from anybody. If it's a crisis to you, it's a crisis to us.
Okay.
Because it can lead to bigger things. And that's the whole idea of getting people help, connecting them with resources in our community before it becomes a 911 crisis. Mm-hmm.
And so what kind of volume of calls are you getting?
We average between 160 and 200 calls a year. It's not a ton, but we focus on our community. So, but if somebody calls from Newport, we don't ever turn them away. If somebody mm-hmm. calls from, we have a fair amount of calls from the Montana side border. Mm-hmm.
But in general, it was set up to cover North Idaho, Bonner, and Boundary counties?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Walk us through a call, why don't you? Tell us what happens if someone's not feeling right and calls your line.
Well, then we call, our clinicians answer. We have a phone service that rotors it around. I'm the final hit, and I'm on 24/7. but if someone calls, and it can be... oftentimes they're in tears. Sometimes they'll just say one word, or I'm really struggling. And then it's using the skills we as clinicians have to help them identify what it is that's going on, tools that they could use, tools that are available with our community, and linking them up to that. Sometimes it's just support. A lot of times it's, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning, if you're very depressed or very anxious, where do you go for support? Mm-hmm. Nowhere. So these are individuals that are trained on how to listen, to provide skills that people can use and go forward.
So everyone that might answer a call has some form of training in counseling or something?
Yes, all of our staff that answer after hours are licensed mental health professionals, and there's a number of them that we use in mm-hmm. the state of Idaho, but they are all licensed.
And what happens if someone calls during business hours?
They are rotated to a voicemail, and I get notification that someone has left, but our message is very clear that we're not open because I don't want someone in crisis mm-hmm. waiting to get mm-hmm. a call back.
Sure.
So I can usually return a call within an hour, but...
So if you're not open then during those hours, so they might then call their healthcare provider or somebody like
correct.
That.
Correct.
Got it.
One of the goals, though, as I understand it, is to expand the service?
It is. We'd like to go 24/7, which would mean during the business hours, Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, because we continue to get calls during the day. People don't leave a message very rarely. And that's partly because our message is very clear. We're not open. So there is a level of need. What those needs are, I don't know. But we've been open almost 2 years, and we are still getting calls during the day.
Sure. Well, mm-hmm. crisis doesn't necessarily happen starting at 6 p.m.,
no,
right?
It does not.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you're the crisis line.
It sounds like even with an evening service, like a huge logistical challenge and one that either is relying on volunteers or is heavily funded.
Our clinicians work for minimum wage, mm-hmm. And that's their commitment to our community. Now, granted, they might not get a call one night, and they get paid for those hours, but the mm-hmm. next time they're on, they might get four.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So it kind of balances out, and and they've all done it. We've had the same clinicians for a lot since we opened.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And when you're on call, you can't be out with friends necessarily.
Right. Or you're just not doing your own thing. Friends. You're
right.
Not.
Yeah. It's a commitment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. So in terms of expanding, it's going to take additional financial capacity, but also the trained professional capacity.
Well, what we would like to do is staff it during the day with volunteers. That is the model that has been used by other crisis centers as they started very small and grew. Mm-hmm. The volunteers would have clinical support. There would be a clinician available for, you know, any call. They would be extensively trained. The training process that I have in place is very similar to what our Idaho Suicide Prevention Hotline uses. So they would be trained in how to handle calls, plus have that clinical support there.
Yes. We've heard, Barb, quite a bit. I'm sorry, Catherine, we've heard quite a bit from you. We just had Barb, but Amy, I'd like to hear how your clinic, how they work together, because we've not heard much from you.
So we work together because the clinic operates one night per week. So I don't currently have mental health professionals that volunteer at the clinic. So a lot of our patients will come in crisis or, you know, needing mental health care, and I can't provide that currently. When Catherine came to us and we're like, you know, hey, could we partner? It was a perfect fit because we can help promote the crisis line with our patients, and it gives our patients an outlet. They can also help, you know, deal with those crises and then send those patients to us for, you know, their medications or to make sure that they're seeing a PCP and somebody has eyes on them medically. So that way it was a perfect fit.
And you're open one night per week, but you're open during the day.
Well, I have a phone that I answer during the day. Yeah, normal business hours, 8 to 5, I answer the phone. And then, yeah, clinic night is one night per week, alternating Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Ah,
okay.
And do you see a large percentage of mental need versus other medical needs?
I wouldn't say large, but it's a pretty good piece of what we see. You know, a majority of what we see is still medical, but depending on the time of year or certain things that are happening, we definitely have more people that are coming in for mental health needs.
Sure. And, you know, your name is Free Clinic, and we have the North Idaho Crisis Line. Are there fees for any of these services then?
No.
Nope.
None. And is there an income requirement? Do you check people's? Mm-mm. No.
Nope.
Yep.
It's pretty, pretty nice. Pretty nice.
Well, a person in crisis is in crisis.
Yes,
that that's moment. Right. Mm-hmm. That's right. So, Phil started down this road, but how are you funded then? How are you able to support yourselves? How do you stay open?
Well, the crisis line has been funded by community donations. The modern community of organizations has been tremendously generous. Other grants, personal donations, and that's kept us going.
So the funding source is coming from foundations, individual donors.
Yes.
It's not a government service.
Oh, not at all. Yeah. We have no connection. We don't.
And we don't either. Nope. The clinic doesn't either. Same thing. Community donations, personal donations, community grants and scholarships and things like that.
So if people are listening and they want to get involved in a supportive capacity, either as a trained volunteer or a potential donor, or they want to help the organizations, who can they get in touch with?
They can get in touch with me, Catherine Peruse, and they can reach me either at our webpage, which is northidahocrisis.org, or they could phone me. I'm looking for volunteers. Yeah. Right now, our holdup on going 24/7 is volunteers.
Yes, and Amy, what about your organization?
So we also are always in need of volunteers, of course. You know, nonprofits are always. All of our staff is volunteers, so our doctors, nurses, admin staff. We have Facebook, so people can always get in touch with me, Facebook, or our website, which is www.bpicc.org.
So you're staffed by local healthcare professionals that are just simply putting in their time to help out.
Yep, I have doctors who come from their clinic to my clinic.
Wow.
Yep, that's a long day.
Yeah. NAMI, I know, also provides other services, the crisis and training. And do you want to talk briefly a little
NAMI
bit about that?
Yeah, NAMI Far North has been involved in outbringing awareness to our community about mental illness and the things that can be done, and that people who have a mental illness doesn't mean that they have to hide in their apartment. I mean, there's things to do, ways to be involved with some understanding. We do a family-to-family training usually once a year, sometimes twice a year, which helps family members learn about mental illness, some of the some long tried and true methods for dealing with someone, their loved one who might be in a crisis. Those are for adults. We also have the basics program, which addresses young families who may be having mental health issues. We have a very good support group that is run by Jan, and that is for individuals living with mental illness, as well as a family support group. Mm-hmm. That meets once a month on the third Wednesday of the month at Bonner General Hospital at 5:30. We have a educational portion, and then we break into support groups.
And so these services might help somebody before they get to the point of needing the crisis line.
Correct.
And again, for more information on the offerings from NAMI?
From NAMI, it's namifarnorth.org. And all of our different groups, programs, supports are there, as well as a link to the crisis line.
Yes, very important. Would either of you have a success story you might be able to share with us?
Yeah, I could. We actually, 101 Women is a local nonprofit that is giving away grants to local nonprofits. And we were actually the first recipient of that last October. And that was a $10,000 grant, which has been able to help us enormously. But we've been able to pay for biopsies, medications, different diagnostic testing, and things that we usually are very restricted on. So that's been a huge success for us this year, being able to pay for so many more things for people to ensure that they stay healthy.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I've got hundreds of success stories. People who are, you know, have needed someone, have called, talked several times in one night. And then when we check, because we try to do a check back 24 hours later, see if they need more resources. And the gratefulness and the relief in talking to them that next day when things have been resolved or moved forward makes it all worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Well, we appreciate you coming in this morning and sharing with us the services, and we encourage our listeners to find out more by going to the websites listed. If you tuned in late and you'd like to hear the interview in its entirety, it'll be available as a podcast later on today at www.krfy.org. This is listener-supported community radio for North Idaho at 88.5 KRFY.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
We're going to segue to a little music break here with some Beatles, and then Julie and I will be back to talk about upcoming events. The Beatles, Help Me, or just Help with an exclamation point.
Perfect song for our previous guests, Phil.
It's wonderful to be in a community, though, where help is available for folks in crisis and for quite a few other things, too. And really, it's a tribute to the wonderful array of nonprofits that we have providing so many services to our community that wouldn't otherwise be available.
I agree.
So we here at The Morning Show quite often feature those nonprofits and other civic issues. Upcoming morning shows, if you are able to tune in tomorrow morning, Wednesday, October 25th, is part two of Local Decision 2017. It's a two-part series, I believe. All of the interviews are up as podcasts. So Chris Bessler, Susie Perez, our hosts, have interviewed all six city council candidates for Sandpoint City Council elections coming up in November. Tomorrow, you'll be listening to interviews with John Darling, John Bonhoff, and Joel Aspero. That's right here at 88.5 KRFY at 8 a.m.
And truly, if you haven't researched your city council candidates, this is a great way to learn more about mm-hmm. them.
And the other three candidates they interviewed last weekend, their interviews are up as podcasts. So do listen to all six before you make your decision. On Thursday, October 26th, join the Thursday morning show with host Jack Peterson and Jim Healy. Their guests this week will be Lisa DeFritis with Bonner Health Community Hospice. That's right here at 88.5 KRFY. We have other fun stuff for the radio station going on. We just wrapped up the online auction. A big thank you to all of those who donated or bid.
That we did. It was a big success. We're just tallying numbers and gathering gifts and awarded online auction items. So soon you'll be able to come pick them up here. Additionally, on Saturday, for those of you who don't know about it yet, we will have an Adopt-a-Highway pickup. That'll be at 1 p.m. So if you're interested in that, you can call the station or you can also email the station. They'll get the request off to me, Julie.
And I want to say every bid counts. Even if your bid wasn't the winning bid, your bid made the winning bidder go that much higher.
That is so true.
And so if you didn't get a winning bid and you would still like to help out, you can always renew your membership. You can donate online or you can stop by the station at any time.
Or become a volunteer. It's really fun, isn't it, Phil?
It is. We enjoy it.
We do.
Next Tuesday, we'll be interviewing Cindy Marks, who is program manager at Community Cancer Services. They'll be talking about their gala event coming up here, A Night to Remember.
Something to look forward to. On to current events, and it is Halloween week, everybody, and so there are a few interesting things happening on the 25th. That would be tomorrow night, Wednesday. We've got Nordic Hound Night. That's the Sandpoint Nordic Club welcoming Grand Teton Brewery to the Hound in town. Anyway, that's a fundraiser for cross-country skiing in the community. If you would like more information about that, go to sandpointnordicclub.sandpointnordicclub.com.
And Thursday is the return of Goat Hop Ale at McDuff's to benefit the Friends of Scotchman Peaks Wilderness. Stop by between 6 and 8 p.m. Until the keg runs dry.
That's right. I'll have to make it to that one. The 26th through the 29th, you may want to watch War of the Worlds radio stage play. Scary. Panada Playhouse Players are taking audiences back in time to the first true on-air thriller, the Orson Welles and Mercury Theater broadcast of the H.G. Wells War of the Worlds. That's going to be, 7:30 p.m. on the 26th and 28th and 3:30 p.m. on the 29th.
Quite a cultural event. That original event really changed broadcast history.
Well, it certainly did. And so don't panic if you run in and watch that program and are confused about whether it's real or not. Of course, you won't be confused because it's at the Little Panada. Now, on Saturday, we've got it's Kinnickinnick Native Plant Society presentation, and the topic is going to be invasive weeds. That's a great topic for our area, isn't it, Phil?
Yes, it is.
It is. Anyway, we'll be hearing from Paul Brusven, and the topic is Biological Control of Invasive Weeds, Newer Agents Being Reared. That's at 9:45 a.m. at the Sandpoint Community Hall. Welcome to the public.
Paul is definitely one of those folks who really knows their insects and their weeds really well. He's a fascinating guy.
It's an interesting topic, a way to avoid pesticides. Additionally, we have a Boobash Costume Ball. That's USA Dance hosting a Boobash Costume Ball in Sandpoint Community Hall. It's a mouthful. That's on the 28th at 7 p.m. For more information, go to usadancesandpoint.org. Also on the 28th, you might enjoy a walk with Jane. Jane Hoover has been a nurse practitioner for 21 years, and she's going to be taking folks on a walk. She does this every fourth Saturday of the month with a different theme or focus. The walk starts with a few minutes of conversation and education. The remainder will be walking and meeting new people in a relaxed, non-judgmental, fun atmosphere. For more information on that, you can call 208-263-3613.
Sounds like the perfect anecdote if you've had a little too much Halloween stuff to go out and take a walk with Jane. But if you haven't had enough, then on Halloween, that is the 31st, spooky films screen at 7 p.m. at the Panada Theater with Night of the Living Dead.
Ooh.
That is one of the original spooky films. And a remastered original of Halloween as a double feature on Halloween night.
There you go. I need to back up because I forgot to mention that Adopt-a-Highway has a Halloween theme. Wear your costume and there will be a prize awarded for the best costume.
So we're going to go out with a little bit of Rolling Stones, their first number one U.S. singles hit. In 1973 on this date. It's called Angie. Goodbye till next week.